Greenside, the IGA podcast.
Also, Mike McCoy, the 2013 U.S.
Zach Johnson, now a two-time major champion after becoming the winner of the 144th Open Championship.
Okay, welcome to Greenside, the IGA podcast. Clint Brown with you. Got Chad Pitts with me today. I want to welcome guest Joe Foley, Director of Regional Affairs for the Midwest region, which Iowa is a part of. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Clint. Thanks, Chad. Really, really happy to be here. I love the podcast format. I love how you say Greenside, too. I remember that from my first episode listening in. And so, really honored to be here. Looking forward to it.
Well, before we dive into things, why don't you just give us a brief introduction of kind of who Joe Foley is?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm, as you said, the Director of Regional Affairs for the Midwest region at the USGA. I'm currently based in New Jersey, but my main sort of role and responsibility at the organization is to manage our I'll just say industry relationships with folks in the Midwest. We have five regional affairs directors across the country. And again, I manage the Midwest region. So everywhere from sort of the Ohio region all the way out to the Dakotas in the northern part of the country, anything the USGA needs to do locally, right? So working with state and regional golf associations, working with USGA committee members, anytime we have an association industry, something to do with the game of golf, any sort of conference or meeting, I'll help sort of represent the national office at those meetings. And it's a cool gig. I mean, it's one of those things where I get to sort of serve as a conduit between what we talk about strategically at the national office and really what's happening, in and around the game of golf locally, at courses, facilities, and specifically with golfers, right? The USGA doesn't have, a strong presence locally, I would say, in terms of, presence at each club or each facility. And so we on the regional affairs team really try to connect what we do at the national office with those local customers and local constituents. So that's the short of it.
Joe, what did you do or what were you doing prior?
Yeah, so I was on our a couple different teams at the USGA. I worked on our rules team for a few years and then moved over to our corporate partnerships team and saw a different side of the business, more of the revenue side and business side versus the golf side of the organization. And so in totality, I've been at the USGA for 7+ years and really enjoyed it. Now kind of back on the golf side, working on the regional affairs team for the past two years or so.
Joe, so you were probably involved with some of the rule changes and stuff that went down a couple of years ago. Now it doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess what was that process like for you?
Yeah, that was an eventful couple of years. It was a process that I got involved in right around 2016, 2017. And I think the new rules went into effect on January 1st, 2019. So about 2 or 3 years of a lot of work. I would say in my role, my main job was to really kind of herd the cats, both at the USGA from a project management perspective, but then externally, when we thought about how we were going to deliver the new rules, educate folks, both officials and players on the new rules, the education process, that certification process, how are we going to roll these out to the public? So sort of on a project management level internally, but then also sort of spreading the word and outreach work on an external level. And it was exciting. I mean, there was a lot of people across the organization that were involved. So folks on our communications team, marketing team, just thinking about how to sort of deliver the key messages and make sure those new changes landed in the right way. But then all the meetings with the RNA, with folks across the industry, the PGA Tour, the LPGA, it was hectic because we hadn't updated the rules on that scale for upwards of 25, 30 years. And so the amount of change, the amount of questions and curiosities people had as we approached the changes to the rules, it was wild and crazy, but I think in a good way. And, 2 years now since those changes went into effect, I think the cool part about it is you don't really hear a ton about the changes now. And I think that's a positive, and that I think people are just sort of used to them now. And I think when you're not talking about the rules of golf, when you're watching or administering an event, I think that's a good thing, because that means they're sort of just doing what they're supposed to do to help sort of bring a structure to the game we play. So it was fun. It was an enjoyable process. Not something you want to do every year of your life, because it was a lot of long days and long nights, but really cool to see how it kind of all turned out.
Hey, Joe, I commend you guys for that rollout, because I thought you guys had prepared so well that when the day finally came, if you will, everything was kind of in place, as you said. And from an educational standpoint, you gave us a lot of resources to use when we went around the state and taught our rural seminars starting that spring. Since you were behind the curtain, and not to put you on the spot too much, but was there any one or two particular things that maybe, any fun stories about how a rule ended up the way it was? Maybe there was some, I don't want to say arguments, but maybe there's some conversations between the RNA and the USGA that you could share now. There's like, yeah, this one thing was kind of a, going back and forth, and it ended up the way it did.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question, Chad. And one of the reasons it's a great question is because it sort of speaks to the process that we went through in implementing the new changes. Never before had we sort of used the feedback period, right, to gather changes on proposals and then ultimately make some changes based upon what we heard from the public. And we released, I think, a proposed set of changes in the early part of 2017 and went through a 6-month feedback period. And it was funny early on in the process, a lot of people, golfers and administrators, sort of reached out to the USGA and said, I mean, guys, are you really going to make any changes based upon like what Joe Golfer or anyone says about the proposals? And a lot of people frankly thought it was lip service that we were having this feedback period and looking to engage with the public. What did that really mean? But on your question, there were, I would say, two or three things that came about from that 6-month feedback period over the course of 2017 that said, that sort of made the committee sort of think twice about some of the changes. One of them, I think you may remember, there was a proposal to have a relief area. So when you're taking relief from a penalty area, which we now call, used to be a hazard, or even cart path relief, there was a for free relief, there was this proposal of like an inch limit, right? 40 inches or 80 inches. And we thought that was sort of an easier way to do it, right? You'd standardize, the space where you could drop from one of these obstructions, right? It made sense, in sort of the boardroom, let's say, or in the meeting room. It'll be standard across the board, and nobody will be getting sort of an advantage based upon their club lengths. But in practicality, when we brought that to the table, people said, well, wait a second, how are we going to go about figuring out exactly how long 40 inches is, 80 inches is? I mean, do we really need to get into this place where we're, putting measuring sticks in our bag, and we already have, clubs that are relatively similar in length. Let's just stick with what we already have. And yeah, club lengths can be a little bit different from player to player, but generally speaking, they're about the same. And so what we did was we basically said, you can't use a longer putter, right? If you still have a longer putter in your bag, that's off limits, but let's go back to club lengths when taking relief, and let's keep it simple. And I thought that was, maybe a small change that people didn't talk a ton about, but a change that, came about specifically because of the feedback we were hearing in the field.
Sure. And, we had that IGA logo tape measure tee gift all set to order, and then you guys changed it. So,
are they still sitting in stock right now? Or what
are you doing? Yeah.
They're sitting along in my office.
Along with our 3-minute timers, but at least those, those came through for us. The other one I remember, Joe, was, I believe, the initial proposal, if you will, for a drop distance was any height, really any height, I think. We were like, basically looking at as little as maybe an inch above the ground. And then it became knee height, I believe, after the feedback period. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, you're spot on. In fact, you're kind of refreshing my memory, because it's been a couple of years and I've been sort of out of the rules game a little bit relative to back in those days. And yeah, that was another change. It's probably more more widely talked about and used, it was going to be any height. And I remember getting a little bit of feedback to say that where folks were saying, well, I mean, any height, I mean, could it be, you know, a half inch off the ground? Could it be less than a half inch off the ground? When do you determine like whether
when's that's a drop become a like, place,
become
right?
a place. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so there was sort of how you enforce that, right? If you think about being, you know, you're an official out on the golf course and you're seeing someone, you know, a couple of holes over trying to maybe drop the ball from really close to the ground. I mean, you know, getting into the situation where you're not sure if someone's placing or dropping, if they're following the rule or not following the rule. And so, yeah, we got to a place where, you know, we wanted it to be close to the ground. So it didn't, so you didn't have to worry about the ball doing all these things once it hit the ground. That's where we had all those relief procedures in the past, where if it rolled more than two club lengths or it you know, if it went into a hazard, I mean, all these things that would require a redrop, at least if we got it a little closer to the ground, then the ball would generally stay in a, you know, the area where it was dropped. And that's where we kind of just turned it to a knee height drop, you know, within a relief area.
Joe, was there, I guess, how to word this, but I guess, was there one thing or another that it just didn't go to a place? Was it a matter of just like, we want to just keep the drop as,
yeah,
as part of the process? I mean, something as simple as that, I guess.
It's a good question. And I think it's one of those conversations that'll probably continue for years, right? At the rules committee level. I think there were people in the room that just thought, well, wait a second, you know, we can get even more simple with the rules by to your point, to your question, mm-hmm. just getting to a place, right? Why wouldn't we do that? I think there were some others though that felt that, you know, the randomness of a drop, sure. you know, in terms of the lie that you're going to get, is probably still the most fair way to go about, you know, the process procedure. And do we get to a place where, you know, someone who is placing the ball three or four times in the round based upon where they've hit the ball, I mean, are they getting a small advantage because of that, over someone, you know, over just being in a situation where they just drop it from knee height? So I think to preserve the randomness of the procedure and the randomness of the lie is why we kind of stuck with that for now.
Joe, just to kind of rewind a little bit, how many regional golf associations do you work with?
Yeah, on a regular basis, I work with 13. We have about 58, 59 across the country, and 13 that sit in the Midwest region.
I had you down as 10 states, but then I got to thinking, well, that could be, you know, more than, you know, because you could have more than, you know, more than one association in a state, which we, you know, which we do have throughout the country. So I was just curious about that.
Yeah, and it's a good point. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but you know, you have some states where you know have a pretty big set of, I'd say just a pretty big area, pretty big region, right, to manage. And so there's, you know, for example, a state like California has a Northern California Association, a Southern California Association. So a lot of the way we structure our associations are kind of based upon where the communities of golfers sit and kind of what you know, what areas sort of fit from a cultural perspective. So yeah, like you said, there's some states where there's a couple of associations, but then there's other states where, you know, you have one association that might span across a couple different states. I'm thinking of the Met Golf Association, sure. Sort of spans across Connecticut, New York, and part of New Jersey as well.
And Joe, one of the states in your region that's, you know, adjacent to us certainly is Illinois. They have a unique situation there, right? With Chicago District. And I think Chicago manages most of the state, but they do not sort of have jurisdiction over the entire state, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. It's a state where, like I said earlier, there's such a strong culture and you know, set of clubs and golfers that are, you know, positioned sort of near Chicago, and it extends outside of Chicago, but in many ways that association is pretty tied up in a lot of business right around the city of Chicago. And so once you get into sort of the southern parts of Illinois, for example, we have an amateur golf association located in St. Louis, the Menam Golf Association, that sort of covers, you know, part of the southern part of Illinois. A lot of those clubs feel like, you know, they kind of are tied more to the city of St. Louis. So, it, you know, a couple of years ago, we sort of drew lines around some of these regions to help make it clear to golfers, okay, I'm a part of this association, not that association. And, you know, a little bit of drawing of those of those lines didn't kind of follow state lines necessarily all the time. Most of the time they do, but not all the time.
And I felt like we were, because we obviously went through that entire process too. And for those that don't know, the Iowa Golf Association boundaries basically are the state of Iowa, except that we also get, if you will, Rock Island County, which is the Illinois county that surrounds the Quad Cities. And so I guess from one way of looking at it, maybe Joe, from the USGA side, we always felt like we were a quote unquote easy golf association when it came to describing the AGA agreements. We kind of, you know, we were bounded by a state essentially. And, you know, we, through our process of working with Chicago, because they don't get all the way to Western Illinois quite as much. We kind of agreed to take that county, which is great for us. And I think it's good for them too. But a state like Ohio, where is in your jurisdiction, they, and I don't know the entire history there, but they have, is there four associations now that kind of work in Ohio? And I guess for the listeners, I'm just kind of curious how, you know, something like the Ohio Amateur Championship, do you know how that, who runs that and how the other associations work together to put that on?
Yeah, so we're at four, like you said. Now, I think as recent as last year, we were at five associations, with the Toledo District Golf Association just sort of falling under now the Northern Ohio Golf Association. They just recently consolidated. But back to my point earlier, I mean, you have four, and I guess you could argue five distinct city centers in Ohio where there's just rich histories and traditions, clubs that are very tied to those cities. And you have associations that were strong, you know, that when we came around to having these agreements signed a couple of years ago to have formal, you know, state and regional golf associations, we call them allied golf associations, AGAs at the USGA. It made sense. It made sense for Ohio to continue to have that many associations. Now, who knows how long that'll last? Maybe they at some point will move closer to sort of two to three, or even you know, down to one or two associations. But it made sense at the time. And you know, you have good volunteer bases, strong staffs at each of those associations. As far as the state amateur goes, it's actually unique because, you know, even though the Ohio Golf Association, which is one of our state associations, runs the event, the other three or four contribute by supporting the qualifiers, right? And supporting the championship by promoting it locally. And so there is a good collaboration across those associations to make sure that, you know, even though one state association, the Ohio Golf Association, runs it, that they're all contributing to help. And that, you know, the Ohio Golf Association in return sort of promotes those other events that are run in Cincinnati or run in Cleveland. There's a Northeast Ohio Amateur that's run in Cleveland. And I know the other associations do a good job of pushing players up to that that area who are willing to play. And Ohio is an interesting state too, because it's, you know, you have so many cities that are in pretty close proximity to each other, right? So within 1, 2, 3 hours. And so it's pretty easy for players to kind of jump around and play at different places.
Joe, kind of piggybacking on the AGA angle, can you kind of talk to me kind of what an AGA kind of means to the USGA, kind of through your lens and like I said, for the USGA as a whole?
Yeah, definitely, Clint. This is, you know, an important question. I think an important question for your listeners in that, you know, as I said earlier, the USGA, I think, would love to do a better job of having a presence locally and really having a presence, you know, within golfers' minds and within, you know, the club and facility space. In terms of thinking about what the USGA does for the game and how we contribute all together to sort of the game becoming a better game 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. We try our best to do that, but without, you know, Allied Golf Association, without state and regional golf associations having that direct connection to clubs and golfers, we don't really have much of a presence at all, right? Think about the rules of golf. Think about the handicapping system, the Gin app. Think about USGA qualifiers, the national championships we run across the country. Without the Allied Golf Association being the conduit, being the connective tissue between us and the local areas, you know, those golfers aren't able to sort of interact and understand and really learn about what the USGA does and really participate in USGA programs and championships. So You guys all, you know, both at the Iowa Golf Association, but also, you know, across the country are really that connective tissue. And without those state and regional associations, we wouldn't be able to, you know, again, communicate what happens nationally, but I would say even one step further, really execute against what we're trying to do. We can have a lot of conversations in the boardroom or in the meeting rooms at the USGA, but you know, without people, you know, committed day in, day out to doing the work locally, you know, those conversations really are irrelevant and not super productive. So, you know, again, we appreciate everything that goes on locally with those state and regional associations.
Hey, Joe, you mentioned briefly the GIN app, the mobile app that that the USGA through GIN kind of provides and through the Iowa Golf Association provides to all of our golfers. That app has really seen a lot of significant upgrades over the last couple of years, hasn't it? Including a pretty recent upgrade that now allows you to do GPS during your round and have mm-hmm. have a GPS functionality built into it. I guess maybe just speak quickly to those things and if there's anything else sort of in the hopper that you're aware of that might be coming down the pike.
Yeah. So you're speaking to a couple of recent changes with the app. And I think they've been met with, you know, with some high praise and positive feedback from golfers. But the GIN app is really, I would say, you know, kind of maybe talking out of one side of my mouth now after I said that we don't have a direct contact with a lot of golfers. I think the GIN app is probably the way that the USGA does connect with golfers, I would say, you know, on the most regular basis. And that's through sort of what all of you do to sort of promote the app and then also sell memberships through your associations. The GIN app is, it has evolved, I'd say, over the last few years. Again, you said the GPS is the most recent addition. We have gone through, you know, I would say a couple of different iterations, some of them sort of around how we sort of track stats or how golfers can track stats and, you know, how golfers can, you know, sort of experience their round and will almost have an app that sort of they can use during the round in a way that sort of is newer than they sort of used to be able to do with the GIN app. I mean, if you think about 5-10 years ago, the handicap system was set up in a way where, you know, you use GIN to simply post a score and see what your handicap was. We're now thinking of the GIN app as almost an accompanying tool that you can use during your round. And so whether it's GPS that you mentioned, you know, some of our enhancements around, you know, green reading and, you know, being able to sort of look at putt break maps and also track your shots sort of through the round and use those stats along the way, it's becoming much more of a sort of golfer friendly, you know, round friendly, I'd say, user experience. And I think we hope that, you know, sort of enhances, you know, people's connection with the USGA, but also their connection and their sort of the value of a membership at the IGA, right? If it's something that is sort of more value to a golfer during their round, then of course it's sort of a more value for them to have a membership at the Iowa Golf Association. So we'll continue to look at updates and enhancements. We don't want it to become you know, too overwhelming of an experience that doesn't allow someone to just simply use the app for you know, primarily the reason of sort of updating their handicap and making sure they have an up-to-date handicap with the matches they play in or the tournaments. So there's a balance there, but whether it's on the sort of social networking front or being able to share your progress, you know, comment on other folks' rounds that you or friends that you have that are playing, you know, those are some of the things that you might see within the GIN app down the road, and it'll continue to evolve, you know, over the coming years.
Joe, you mentioned your work with the, you know, the rule changes and that, and I was just curious what maybe some other experiences you've had since you've been with the USGA that you kind of reflect back on and have been kind of highlights for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. So, I mean, even though I've spent some time on the rules, I mean, there's in the partnerships department, along with the role I have now, you know, there's a lot of things that come up at the USGA where we're pulled into different conversations or different projects because, you know, because there are times where you have to just sort of have all hands on deck, particularly around championships, as you mentioned. And so there have been a couple of unique opportunities I've been able to experience. One of them was, a couple of years ago, I served on our player relations team, you know, during the US Open. So both at 2017 at Erin Hills and 2018 at Shinnecock on Long Island in New York, I basically worked with our player relations, player services team throughout the week. And basically we're sort of in service to the players that were on site as they arrived, when they were setting up practice rounds, when they were sort of, you know, setting up accommodations for their families while they were playing in the championship. And that was unique because, you know, was able to kind of meet a lot of the players that came through, you know, learn a little bit more about them, meet with them face-to-face, have conversations about anything they were curious about on the golf course or as it relates to anything the USGA is doing. And to see a different side of them is interesting. You get folks that, you know, you would expect to get a certain personality from, but then those that just completely surprise you, right? I remember meeting Tony Finau for the first time and, you know, getting a chance to see sort of that laid back nature, which I assumed, you know, would be the case, but it was even more than I thought it would be. He was sort of hanging out in that office the entire week. You know, there was like a little ping pong table set up and a little basketball hoop. And you would have never known it was the week of a major championship. He was hanging out with us during the week. I mean, had never really met us before, but shooting hoops, playing ping pong and really relaxed. And in many ways that might've helped him play well that week. That might help him play well in other weeks. But just a cool experience. I would say another cool experience would be the way I was able to kind of participate in some of the rules committee meetings, right? So being in the room as those rules changes were being debated at the table in Scotland or here in the States. And, you know, just being a fly on the wall, whether or not I was participating in the conversation or more of just a listener, it was just cool to be kind of in the room, you know, seeing really change for our game happen kind of in real time. So those I'd say are the couple ones that kind of stand out.
Be sure to check back with us next time on Greenside, the IGA podcast, as we continue our conversation with Joe Foley of the USGA.